Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And on our show today, we'll be talking with Associate Professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences and the Director of the Duke Aging Center Family Support Program, Lisa Gwyther, about Alzheimer's disease and families. A super important topic and a difficult one for many families.
Yes, and Christy, I've got so many friends right now who have parents that are having Alzheimer's disease and at all ages, and this is important and it's personal. I'm glad we have her here. But first, we also have some really important research that matters.
And the first research is actually about Alzheimer's disease, and we've also had some research about positive psychology and fish oil and something called teledermatology.
Well, let's dive right in with research on Alzheimer's disease and perhaps some what we know about maybe mental exercise as a way of trying to help out. Some research that was in the Archives of Neurology.
And, I mean, just for context, Alzheimer's disease, I mean, the estimates are that there are 36 million people who have this worldwide, and that as the population ages, that number will increase to 66 million by 2030 and to 115 million by 2050. So, I mean, a significant problem now and will be a growing problem if we aren't able to figure it out.
And so for this particular research, the researchers looked at 75 healthy people who are age 60 and older, and to look at mental activity, things like reading, writing, playing games, comparing the brain scans of these healthy people with those of Alzheimer's patients, and then also much younger healthy people who were much younger.
And what they found were that people who challenged their brains throughout their lifetimes, who did the reading and writing and games and those things along the way, are less likely to develop these protein deposits in the brain that are linked with Alzheimer's compared with people who didn't do those brain activating things throughout their lives.
And it didn't seem to matter if it didn't really seem to help if they had taken up these types of reading, writing, playing games, sorts of exercises later in their life. You needed a kind of a lifelong kind of pattern here to have the best effect.
And, I mean, I think on the one hand, that's not the best study in the world. It required people to remember back to what they did growing up. But on the other hand, it reinforces a lot of what people believe, in that trying to keep your brain sharp and being active with your brain throughout life is a good thing and may help protect you.
So crossword puzzles are good, Christy.
They're good.
Bingo.
They're better if you start when you're young.
Bingo is good because I've actually played bingo with my mother and her husband and on a cruise ship once, and I saw how they play bingo. They've got like 8 cards going at one time.
Very competitive.
It's very stressful and a lot of mental activity.
And there are also so many games that you can play on your computer, and hopefully Words with Friends on my iPhone is really going to pay
off for
me.
While you're not walking and going into the fountain. Well, let's look at our very next research that matters, which I thought was an interesting article from the Archives of Internal Medicine that I thought would show huge impact. Positive psychology would really help us. If we think better, we're going to be better.
Well, and yes. And so I read this and believe in it, you know, and this idea is that to use the psychology technique that encourages people to think positively, to gain confidence, to believe in, to feel positively about what they're doing, whether that's taking medicines or exercise or just self-affirmation, that would have health benefits. That concept to me, I want to believe it.
Well, they looked at 3 groups of patients, those with high blood pressure that were encouraged to stick with their medication plan, and the other 2 who had asthma or who had recently had a procedure done who agreed to exercise more. And all of them had contracts with their doctors about their goals, and half of them got this positive thinking group.
And the strategy of this positive thinking and these studies did not always lead to obvious health benefits. So in the blood pressure study, there was a little bit of success with the people in the positive thinking group, maybe a little more likely to take their medicines, but there wasn't a difference of real change in blood pressure between the groups over time.
In the
time.
Asthma group, there was not a clear effect on physical activity.
And there was, you know, a little bit of benefit in patients to receive extra exercise encouragement after having a heart stent inserted. But overall, the research was not, overly positive.
It doesn't mean that you shouldn't think positively.
Exactly.
And but I that's think, because it's the right way of for a lot of people approaching it. But it's intrinsically beneficial, not necessarily for some of these other health outcomes that it's harder to measure.
Well, and we might just not have figured out how to measure it yet, but it's a safe thing to do, to affirm yourself, to encourage each other and to think positively. So I say keep on thinking positively.
And I think the more you study this, the more we'll see. I think you're
I
right,
agree.
Christy. It's about measuring. Well, let's talk about measuring our very next research study from the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition about fish oil and potential benefits for muscle and exercise.
So this was a study of older women. We know that people who get more fish oil, get more omega-3 fish oils, have been found to have a lower risk of heart disease. This is a study to see if older women might be able to boost their muscle strength by adding fish oil supplements to their exercise routine.
Yeah, so these women were not necessarily deficient in fish oil or the omega-3 fatty acids, and they were assigned to one of three different exercise groups where they performed strengthening exercise 3 times a week for 3 months. The other groups had the same sort of exercise regimen, but they also took 2 grams of fish oil a day to see if that actually had different health impacts.
And they found that doing the strength training for 3 months plus the fish oil did help increase muscle strength among the patients who did both things. But it's sort of unclear whether or not that translates into overall better health or anything about, you know, being a little bit stronger, if that makes a difference to decrease falls or lots of things we could assume might make a difference. We just don't know yet.
Yeah, I think this is premature for us to recommend that you start taking fish oil if you have no other reason to, just to help out your overall fitness. But it's interesting to think about, if you are taking fish oil already and are having no side effects, mm-hmm. this may be an extra benefit.
An extra positive reason, right?
There you go. Well,
okay.
Speaking of positive reasons, let's go to our very last research article that looks at video consults. So when you come in with a condition and perhaps there's a telemedicine consult with a specialist, is it beneficial or not?
So this word teledermatology is when a primary care doctor or someone out in a physician needs help from a dermatologist, uses the video consult for about 15 minutes with a dermatologist who can see the primary care doctor and the patient, and they have a visit through the video camera.
Right. So this article in the Archives of Dermatology looked at 1,500 patients that had this telemedicine by a skin doctor, and looking at how many of those patients had a change in diagnosis or had a different maybe therapy before versus after. And it was the majority of these patients.
It was. 70% of the patients had some change of diagnosis or an additional therapy recommended by the dermatologist. When I read that, Adam, I don't know what you thought, but I thought, well, this is a good thing. I'm not going to diminish that. But I don't know that that gives me very much information, because I wouldn't call a dermatologist and go to the trouble to video cam them if I didn't have a question that I hoped they would.
Or if the patient wasn't getting better to start with.
Right, exactly. So I would hope they would offer something new, because that's the reason I'm calling.
Right. So this does not mean that if you have a diagnosis of a skin problem from your primary care physician, that you shouldn't believe that, because the great majority of those cases never came to this telemedicine.
Exactly.
But perhaps if you aren't improving after a reasonable trial with any doctor for any condition, a second opinion could be fine.
Absolutely. And it's exciting to think this is another example of using technology, using video to help improve access, particularly for rural areas where it might be harder to get into the dermatologist, or if you had to wait for 3 hours, or it was a lot of trouble to go to another doctor's office. This is a neat way to bridge that.
Yeah, if you need to wait 3 hours, you better be going to another provider for in any case, potentially. But that's going to conclude our research that matters. We've been able to talk about video consults and maybe when they might be most useful.
To talk about positive psychology, talk about fish oil.
And also, finally, how to keep the brain sharp to potentially prevent Alzheimer's. And it will be wonderful to talk with Lisa Gwyther after our short break about Alzheimer's disease and families. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking with Lisa Gwyther, Associate Professor in the Department of Psychiatry at Duke University and Director of the Duke Aging Center Family Support Program, about Alzheimer's disease and families. Really a critically important topic that I don't think we think enough about.
And, you know, Lisa has also directed education in a variety of different ways through an Alzheimer's Disease Research Center for many, many years. And so we are grateful to have you with us, Lisa, to talk about Alzheimer's disease and families.
Thank you. It's good to be here. I'm a big fan of your show.
Well, we like you for that alone. And we, in the interest of just letting our listeners know, you are also the wife of one of our co-hosts, guest co-hosts, Dr. Bob Gwyther at times. So we've got to know each other in a variety of settings. It's so nice to have you here.
Well, thank you.
But one of the things I don't think that I know and
I don't
our
know.
Listeners wouldn't know is, how did you get interested as a social worker in Alzheimer's disease? Because you couldn't have known when you started that this was going to be one of the major diseases facing the United States and world populations.
I didn't. When I started at Duke over 30 years ago as a social worker in the Aging Center, I was assigned to a neurologist who was doing the first studies of younger onset, the rarer form of Alzheimer's disease. And in working with the families that he was seeing in research, it became obvious that there was no source of information. There was no National Alzheimer's Association. There was no way to connect people with other people in the same boat. And so I really did it out of identifying a gap and saying we should do something about this. And at the same time, there was a National Alzheimer's Association starting, and we were actually able to get in on the ground floor.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what you do with Alzheimer's patients and their families. Give us a little snippet of the kind of patient that you are involved with their family.
Well, first of all, we are a central one-stop clearinghouse for anyone in North Carolina, an individual with a concern about memory loss, a family member with a concern about a relative, or a professional with a concern about how to care for somebody. And so usually what happens is we get a call, and often it's from a worried daughter who said, I think my dad is changing, and that changing is real critical in some way. And I can't seem to get him to see his doctor. And he keeps insisting there's nothing wrong with him. It's just normal aging. So we may help that daughter work through how to get her father to get a good evaluation and why it's important.
And when we're thinking about Alzheimer's disease, let's just define really what it is we're talking about. I think people in their own minds perhaps hear that term all mm-hmm. the time. But are we talking about just people who lose their memory and this happens to 10, 20% of the population as they get older? What are we really talking about here? And how big is the problem?
It's a big problem. It is a disease process. It implies a change in the person's ability to do their normal work or daily life routines. So it is a disease process. It is not normal aging. It is a growing public health problem. It is common. It's the most common cause of progressive memory loss in older people. And it is one of a number of causes, but it is the most common cause. So I like to tell people, you know, the C's. It's common. It's chronic. That means you learn to live with it. It's costly, and it's costly both in public and private costs. It's costly emotionally, and it's costly physically, both to the person and the family. It also involves sometimes a loss of control and a lot of family conflict. So, you know, all five of those C's might be important. And for most families, it's really catastrophic in terms of what it does to family life over time.
Well, give us a idea of, I mean, I think a lot of people, as they're aging, who can't remember things quite as well, are afraid of what does that mean. Family members are afraid of, well, my mom couldn't remember this fact. Of how you help guide families and patients to distinguish what is normal aging and what is not.
Yeah, that's become a very difficult thing and something that a lot of people are worried about. The first thing I tell families is it is a significant change that is either noticed by the person in a lot of situations or noticed by the family. And usually it involves initially repeating stories, difficulty doing common things they could do well, like handling the bills, paying bills, handling finances, handling medications. Sometimes families, first thing they notice are changes in behavior or personality, as well as changes in memory, changes in language, changes in what the person's willing to do. They become less, they have less initiative. They may be less willing to engage in things that they normally enjoyed. Often that's because they're having more difficulty doing those sorts of things. That implies a disease process. The kind of forgetting that people are very familiar with that doesn't mean a disease process is you're at a party and you run into something with somebody and you know their name, but for that moment you forgot it. And you know how to fake it and ask the right questions and sound like you know who they are. And then later on that night when you get home and you're in bed, all of a sudden the name comes to you when it can't do you any good.
That's happened to you, too.
Yes, absolutely.
That sounds very descriptive.
That's normal forgetting. That actually starts in your 40s. People start noticing this in their
40s. Christy hasn't had that happen yet.
It's starting early.
It progresses. People become much more sensitive to it as they age. But people with frank Alzheimer's dementia, which is the most common, Alzheimer's is the most common cause of dementia. People with frank dementia, by the time they get home from that party, they don't remember even being there, more or less forgetting the person's name.
We're talking with Lisa Gwyther about Alzheimer's disease in the family. And Lisa, I know I've had a patient in the past for whom after the patient left, the spouse came and got me and said, you know, next time you see this patient, I really want you to talk about memory. I'm concerned they may have early Alzheimer's. And then the next time I saw them together, I brought these issues up. The patient denied it, and I looked over at the spouse, and there was no recollection of the first conversation that they had. What's going on with the family here as it presents, even in the clinical encounter where we have a hard time talking about this?
Right. We have a very hard time talking about it. And very often, spouses will approach the doctor privately because they don't want to embarrass or confront the person. And the person has already let them know they are not interested. They don't think this is an issue. And for many people with early Alzheimer's disease, they really lose that ability to evaluate themselves and to recognize the changes that may be apparent to employers or family. So spouses will try to delicately tell the doctor, but they don't want to confront the person in front of the doctor because after they leave your office, they're going to get it from their husband or mm-hmm. wife about, why did you bring that up? You just nag me too much, or you expect too much. So families have to walk a very delicate line in getting people the evaluation they need, but also getting them preserving their dignity and their sense of self-esteem.
So the door's been open, but I have to keep it open as a provider, because recognize that even though that conversation didn't take us anywhere that day, there needs to be future conversations, because still one of the family members and maybe others are concerned.
Absolutely.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but when we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Lisa Gwyther, about Alzheimer's disease and the family. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Golston and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Golston and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Golston and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Associate Professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences and Director of the Duke Aging Center Family Support Program, Lisa Gwyther, about Alzheimer's disease and families. And Lisa, before the break, we were talking a little bit about the challenges of navigating a family concern with a patient's own sort of recognition or willingness to accept changes that are happening. And I wonder, when you make the diagnosis, you can think of it in different ways. It's about the individual, but it's very much about the family and what that means in the whole context of it all. And how do you deliver that news or discuss that with families of the diagnosis itself and what that means?
Actually, the Alzheimer's Association has come out with some principles of a dignified diagnosis for physicians to use. I usually see people as a social worker or talk with them after the physician has delivered the news, whether it was dignified or whether it was satisfactory to the family or not. Mm. But what I try and tell families from the start is, look, you didn't get this in one day. This is a disease that changes the brain over many years before you have frank symptoms. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to deal with it all in one day either. It's a chronic disease. You need to learn to live with it. But the most important thing is to find ways for the person to continue to feel included and purposeful and have mm-hmm. something to do. But that something to do may need to be adapted to their current capacities.
Well, I would imagine there's a lot, in receiving that diagnosis, there may be a lot of fear on the element of the patient and also on the family that might be different types of fears.
Exactly.
How do you navigate that with families?
Well, first of all, you have to understand that the most common fear of people with this diagnosis, if they're aware, is a loss of control. Mm. Control over decision making, control over things like driving, like finances, and everything that affects them. For the family, it's also a fear of the loss of that person and their relationship as they knew it. So there's a lot of sadness. There's a lot of grief at the beginning. But there's also a lot of fear of the unknown. Will I not recognize you? Will I be subjected to care from people I won't know? Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of initial fear of who will be making decisions for me. And for the spouse or children, their interdependent future is really a major source of fear. And, families describe this in really excruciatingly sensitive detail. I'll never forget one wife who said, I can no longer talk to my husband about things like taking out the garbage, about the daily news in the way we used to. Mm-hmm. We've lost that sense of intimacy and that sense of conversation, just daily conversation that we took for granted.
Well, how then, you've mentioned this loss of control and the need for family members to help those with Alzheimer's feel included and purposeful. Mm-hmm. So what are the practical tips when you're working with families that help let families include and be purposeful and have that control as long as possible?
What I do with families is say, let's look at your typical day and see if we can't find a way that you can do more things that you enjoy doing to either together or separately. Find ways that you can adapt activities that were previously enjoyable and find more things to do in a way that you can continue to do them and with people that you want to be with. So sometimes it's a matter of letting friends know that, yes, he would still like to continue to play tennis. And maybe he can't keep score at the game, but he wants to hit balls and he wants to have people that he can go out and practice tennis with at regular intervals. The other thing I tell families is that just thinking, remembering, and keeping it all together is harder and more exhausting when you have a brain disease like Alzheimer's. So people have to save their energy. They need more frequent breaks, more frequent rest from stimulation. So it's balancing stimulation and retreat in a way that makes it doable for people who are dealing with brain damage like this.
Now, you have written something called the Alzheimer's Action Plan. I wonder if you might share with us briefly, what exactly is that? It sounds delightful. I mean, at least it sounds helpful.
It's a family guide. It was written in 2009. It's a paperback book. And it starts at the earliest recognition of some problem in memory by the person or the family member and takes them through what to expect from an evaluation, how to reorganize or restructure their life if they determine that they do have Alzheimer's disease, what sorts of medicines might be prescribed, how to make sure that all their other conditions that might contribute to their dementia are treated, because that will make them function better and feel better, like depression. Mm-hmm. So it basically takes them through the steps from the beginning of recognition through, say, the moderate stages of dementia.
So a very
it doesn't deal
plan
with
from the beginning.
Yeah, from the beginning.
About.
But it's more about the early changes and how to respond to early changes and how to learn to live with this.
Well, I like the I like the alliteration of Alzheimer's Action Plan, but also like the concept of control, like taking action, and the fact that that speaks to what you were saying earlier of that need to have some control and the fear of losing it.
Right.
Well, and you know, one of the things that I know that I heard from you earlier was that one of the ways to take control is actually some of the research that you're doing and encouraging people to take part in potentially some research studies. And I wouldn't have thought of necessarily linking up taking control with maybe participating in prevention and other research studies. Tell us a little bit about that work and how that may be helpful to families.
Well, first of all, people with Alzheimer's disease and their families don't want to feel helpless. And a lot of people like a proactive approach. Mm-hmm. So people with Alzheimer's disease may want to participate in clinical trials. But the exciting direction that we're going in now is looking at those family members who may have seen a relative or lost a relative to Alzheimer's disease, and they want to do something to change that kind of prognosis for the future, for their children and grandchildren. And so many of them are signing up for a new idea called the Alzheimer's Disease Prevention Registry. And this is a group of people in the triangle who are over 55, who do not now have a diagnosis of Alzheimer's, but many of them have experienced Alzheimer's in a relative. They've watched a relative deteriorate with Alzheimer's, and they want to take positive action. And for some people, that's a way of dealing with the fear of, am I going to be next?
And so tell us again the registry.
It's called the Alzheimer's Disease Prevention Registry. And actually, if you Google the Bryan, B-R-Y-A-N, Alzheimer's Disease Research Center, you can register securely online for that registry. All they want to know, it's not a consent to participate in any study. It's all they want to know is how you prefer to be contacted. And they will let you know about available studies, again, for people who do not have Alzheimer's but want to be involved in prevention.
And for people who want to be involved in policy or in legislative issues, are there things that families can do to help advocate on the broader scale?
Absolutely. Through the Alzheimer's Association, there's a new National Alzheimer's Project Act that's trying to develop a federal plan for Alzheimer's research as well as for services. There's an advocacy group on the national level and on the state level dealing with Alzheimer's disease in terms of research and services.
Yeah, I know actually last year just got something in the mail asking me would I share information about Alzheimer's disease with my neighbors. So that's very simple fundraising and very simple letter to, I think, 25 neighbors, and $300 or $400 came in. So there's things that don't take a whole lot of time that we could all participate in because this affects all of us. So
it is a major public health problem.
Yeah.
And most people realize that this is probably the public health epidemic of our future because of the numbers of people who are reaching the age at greatest risk.
Well, we want to thank Lisa Gwyther, author of the Alzheimer's Action Plan, lecturer, professor. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom, experience, passion, and being there for Alzheimer's disease patients and their families.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me.
Thank you, Lisa.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I are going to spend some time talking about your health questions and concerns.
You can send your own questions to yourhealth@unc.edu. And Christy, we've got some interesting questions today from listeners about Skechers shape-ups, about high and low blood pressure, leftover medication, not food, and finally about dizzy spells.
I know. We've got some good ones today. I'm looking forward to this. The first one is about Skechers shape-ups. Let's hear the question.
Recently, I've seen a lot of ads on TV for these shoes that are supposed to help you shape and tone your legs and butt. Skechers shape-ups. Do you think these actually work, or are they just another marketing ploy?
I'll be honest, Christy. I had never heard of Skechers shape-ups. Matter of fact, that's a hard thing to say
what?
Fast three times. Skechers shape-ups, Skechers shape-ups. That's a hard thing. But this must be something very popular and very large economically marketed.
Yeah, a lot of people are walking around in these shoes that are, you know, supposed to help tone your legs while you're just walking around at work rather than having to go to the gym.
They kind of look like Noah's Ark to me.
They
have this shape, and I'm
funny
like,
looking.
That looks like I might get injured while I use them.
Well, interestingly, I think the Skechers Shape Ups company says, oh, you burn more energy, you burn muscle develop muscles while you're walking. And so, you know, the concept of it is, you know, you're having to work a little harder when you're walking around because you're having to try to constantly keep your balance when your foot is in a position that it's not normally in.
Well, so the question is, does this really work? And I don't think either one of us could find any really good research that says this actually works. But what we're really talking about is any specific exercise that helps you get more fit in your legs and buttocks, anything that specifically works those areas will help. So, you know, is there any damage here, I guess?
Well, I think there are a lot of podiatrists apparently concerned about, you know, putting your foot in a in a space that it's not supposed to and constantly having to regain your balance isn't necessarily a good thing and wouldn't replace the need to go out and like really work it out at the
gym.
And
some people, what we frequently talk about is 90% of foot problems are really shoe problems. And so having some shoes here that maybe throw your balance off, we did come across some class action lawsuits from some people claiming that they were injured. We don't know about that, but we do know that that is some cause for concern. I don't think I would be recommending these. I'd recommend the old-fashioned. Go to the gym, get a personal trainer, work on some really good exercises that strengthen your quadriceps, glutes, hamstrings.
Yeah, but at this point, I don't see a whole lot of, oh my gosh, these things are terrible either. So, you know, you have to make your individual decision, but don't give up diet and exercise and the tried and true getting that heart rate up and working it out.
Speaking of heart rate, let's listen to our very next question about blood pressure.
What constitutes high and low blood pressure? At what range should I worry and go see a doctor?
Well, it's tricky, especially the low blood pressure part. I'll let you do the high blood pressure part, Adam, and then I'll take the hard part.
Well, we know that high blood pressure, the definition has changed over time. And what we typically used to think of as the 140 over 90 or that systolic blood pressure, the top number, and the diastolic blood pressure, the bottom number, that we want to see those numbers lower. And depending on whether or not you have some other health problems, much lower. And so nowadays, we really would like to see that top number be less than 120 even, and that bottom number certainly be less than 80. So for most patients, I say, Christy, we want that blood pressure to be as low as possible. So how do we then define what's low?
Well, it's tricky because you have all these athletes out there who have blood pressures that, you know, the top number's normally 90 or something, and that's where they live, and have no symptoms and feel fine. And that's okay for a young, healthy person if their blood pressure, maybe that top number is 90 or 100. But some other person might have a number in that range that they feel dizzy or they feel sick or they're, you know, their heart is hurting because there's not enough blood going around.
Well, certainly if you feel dizzy or sick and your blood pressure is at almost any level, you probably should end up seeing the doctor. And if it were blood pressure was less than 100 systolic and you feel dizzy and sick, you probably should go see the doctor. I had a patient, though, who thought their normal blood pressure should be 140 over 90 because they had high blood pressure. And so they didn't want to make it lower because they thought getting it lower would make them feel worse. But once it actually got down to 120 over 80, they felt the same way they did. And I said, you know what? You're healthier now.
Mm-hmm. It's true. And, you know, particularly if you have diabetes or if you have known heart disease, there are lots of reasons why it's very important. I mean, one interesting fact is that if you have diabetes, getting that blood pressure down in terms of your long-term health and preventing heart attacks and stroke and kidney disease and all that, the blood pressure is as important or more important than your blood sugar if you have diabetes. So, I mean, getting your blood pressure down, especially if you have other problems, is really important for your health.
Thank you so much for your question. Let's listen to our next house call, Christy, about leftover medication.
I'm starting to get a cold and wanted to use the leftover medication I was prescribed the last time I was sick, but it has expired. Do expiration dates really compromise the integrity of the medication?
Let me ask you a question, Christy. Do you have any leftover medication in your medicine closet?
Yes. And have I taken it? Yes.
No way. I think I may have done it once before.
Once, really? Well, I have.
Usually it's about like things like Advil or things like that that aren't like antibiotics.
Oh, yeah. But I have called a pharmacist before to say, I have this leftover medication. Is it safe to take? You know, a medicine that maybe just take every now and then as needed. But it once it's expired, it's like, well, is it safe? I mean, this is a really great question. And what I've learned is that there is, with most medicines, a slow decrease in effectiveness over time. So for most medicines, if you take it, it, you know, expires after a year, and you take it one day after that, you know, nothing terrible is going to happen, but it may not work as well.
But my seizure medication and my medicine for my heart disease, those are, and my blood pressure medicine, my diabetes medicines, when those expire, I don't want to be taking those.
No, you don't, because what's the point of taking them if they don't work as well? And then there are medicines like acetaminophen or Tylenol that can actually be harmful if, as they are expired and degrade into things that you don't want to put in your body. So I think it's not a good idea to take expired medications, and I'm sorry to admit that I did it once. But
well, and for these cold preparations, you know, I guess one of the real questions is, did you need the medicine even to start with? But talk with your doctor about it. Maybe see when the actual expiration date. A lot of times, many of us have medicines in our closet that are 4 and 5 years out of date.
Yeah, just
those are worse
away.
Than leftover food in the refrigerator. They're leftover medicines and probably need to dispose of.
Yeah, while we're at it, if you go in your closet, just go on in there and throw all those old bottles away. It's time to throw them away. It's not safe.
Don't put them
for
in the
children,
toilet.
For
don't
anyone.
Put them in the toilet because we don't want to put all these antibiotics and chemicals into our water supplies.
Good point.
Put them in the trash can. That's where they belong.
Okay, let's take our very last house call question of the day.
Drs. Goldstein and Page, lately I've been experiencing dizzy spells when I stand up from a seated position. Sometimes my vision even goes black temporarily. I thought it was because I've been getting up too quickly, but even when I get up slowly, it still happens sometimes. What do you think this could be, and do I need to see my physician about it?
Well, this is a complicated question. This is not an easy question.
No, it's not. There's so much more. I mean, when a patient comes in to see me, and I'm sure it's the case for you, Adam, with dizziness, I mean, it really requires a full evaluation because it can be so many different things.
But I can tell you, Christy, for myself, I actually have – this is not my question, but I have the same problem. And it's in part because I have a resting heart rate of about 42.
Because you're an athlete.
Well, I'd like to think that I was at one time, but it's also – that's where I'm genetically programmed at some elements. And so when I stand up quickly, my blood pressure drops because my heart rate is low. And until my heart rate speeds up enough, I get dizzy. So what I've learned is I can't stand up quickly because of my low resting heart rate.
And so you adjust, right?
That's right. And I get those little black spots.
In this case, it could be lots of reasons, and that's why I'd love to talk with you more, but it could be your medications. I mean, it's possible that you're either on medications that block your heart rate and your ability to adjust when you stand up, or that you have your blood pressure too low.
Well, Christy, I think that will sum up what we can talk about on House Calls today. We appreciate all your questions. And if you have ones that you want to send to us, you can send them to us at yourhealth@unc.edu.
We want to let you know you can email us at yourhealth@unc.edu, visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, go to Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes.
We'd like to thank WCHL, the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Lisa Gwyther. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And we can't wait to talk with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners.